I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast Special Emergency Edition, Thursday, November 29th, 2018. The United States awoke this morning to a new plea by Michael Cohen, this one not with the Southern District of New York and not about porn stars or payments that may or may not violate campaign finance law. This one is with special counsel Robert Mueller, and it is about Russia and its relationship with the Trump Organization in the context of President Trump's campaign for President of the United States. That is, it's about Trump Tower Moscow. Remember Trump Tower Moscow? That was the building that Felix Sater and Michael Cohen were negotiating to build in Moscow during the period of the campaign. And that is actually when this was, and how involved the president was is precisely the subject of this indictment. Michael Cohen told both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees that he only briefed the president a couple times, and that the deal was done and ditched for business reasons by January of 2016, before the Iowa caucuses and the campaign really even got started. He has now pled to that not being the truth. He's admitted, according to the criminal information submitted today, that the Moscow project was discussed multiple times within the company and did not end in January 2016. He admitted that he agreed to travel to Russia in connection with the Moscow project and actually took steps in facilitating the candidates, that's President Trump's, travel to Russia during the campaign. He admitted that he actually had communications with Russian officials. In fact, Dmitry Peskov, the press secretary for President Putin himself, and spoke to a member of that office in detail about the Moscow project. With me to talk about all aspects of this, remotely from New York, Anthony Cormier of BuzzFeed News, whose amazing story about the Trump Tower Moscow project with Jason Leopold from back in May lays out a huge amount of the information that Cohen has now admitted to. And here in the Jungle Studio, Paul Rosenzweig and Susan Hennessy. So we're going to start with Anthony, and then we're going to have a brief conversation with him and then turn to Susan and Paul. Anthony, thanks for joining us. I want to start with the last time we did a podcast on this subject, which was on May 17th, 2018, which was the day that you and Jason released your giant story on Trump Tower Moscow and its history. And first of all, I think you're not going to say this, so I want to say it for you, that that was knowably then an incredible piece of work, but the events of today, I've rarely seen a criminal charge so closely track the trajectory of a story as this one does that. So I want to just start by, you know, congratulating you and referring readers and listeners back to that original story.
Thank you. You're terribly kind. I have to stop you, though. I cannot believe that was, what, less than 6 months ago. It feels like it was eons.
It does, right?
It feels like the speed at which we're all moving is pretty remarkable.
So, first of all, for a detailed discussion of the thing, we will re-up today the podcast that we did at the time where you talked
Very
through
cool.
that story in detail. But I want to start with the question of what is in this charging instrument, this criminal information, that is not in the story? Is there anything actually new here, or is everything in this document?
Well, I mean, it's not everything. I don't know that we. I mean, some of the details about this assistant one, I'm a little fuzzy on. We didn't as explicitly as federal prosecutors lay out say the number of times that he actually briefed the president on the matter, but it does appear on a first read, and as you probably know, I've been reporting mostly, not reading the indictment. On a first read, it feels that it's mostly tracks pretty closely with what we reported, that the Michael Cohen told Congress that the deal ended at a certain date. We later found text messages, emails, other correspondence that showed them clearly working this thing pretty actively well beyond that cutoff, and into actually the, I think it was, you know, into the deep into the campaign. They were, you know, discussing a trip for the president to visit Moscow, frankly, to actually meet with Vladimir Putin, which seems remarkable now, but at the time, you know, Michael said it wasn't true, and ultimately we got our hands on receipts that showed it, that it was, and now it appears that Mike is copped to it. Well, not appears, he has copped to that lie, and it does appear that he has been a very, very willing cooperator with the special counsel's office.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. I want to come back.
Sure, that's really important.
I want to come back to the details of the story, but you know, there's been a lot of talk this week about Paul Manafort and what a bad bad boy he's been, bad cooperator, even to the point of functioning as an intelligence operation against the special counsel's office for the president. This document is what it looks like when a cooperator has been a very good boy. Is that fair to say?
That is 100% accurate. So you've got Paul on one hand breaking agreements and actually sort of ferrying secret information back to the president in what appears to me to be a bid for a pardon. I can't see another thing going on here. And on the opposite, the yang to that is Michael Cohen, who is in no way, shape, or form at this point planning to do anything but willingly cooperate with the special counsel's office, not only to save his own hide, right? Not only to sort of potentially personally redeem himself, but he truly does feel that the actions that the campaign took were illicit, and I'm going to use a sort of vague adjective here, but unpatriotic. He feels like he is now attempting to help the Republic, which sounds so crazy, and I don't want to do hashtag resistance. But Michael is not bidding for a pardon. He's not trying to make nice with the president. He doesn't like the president. And he feels that the president and his cronies not only hung him out to dry, but actively sought to discredit him. This is from sources who are close to Michael and his and sort of understand his thinking. But he is actively in the game and is trying to help prosecutors solve the ultimate riddle, I think, at this point.
All right, so we have one of the most interesting features of this charging instrument, which I've read pretty carefully now, is that it describes a series of interactions between Trump and Cohen. But it describes them entirely in terms of what Cohen did in those interactions. So, for example, that he briefed the president. It doesn't say anything, or the candidate at the time. It doesn't say anything about how the candidate responded, right?
Go ahead. On purpose, I can assume at this point, right?
Oh, absolutely.
They are.
It is not. But do we know anything about that? Do we know anything about, you know, from Cohen's, you know, this is stuff that Mueller knows the answer to, right? Because he has Cohen as a cooperative witness.
Yes.
He's in a super cooperative posture. And that means when he says he briefed the president more than three times and he briefed the family on the deal and he tried to arrange travel, he knows what the responses to these things are. Do we know anything about what the answer to that question is?
I can't
either from
say
your
exactly.
your reporting or anybody else's.
Well, no, I mean, we've been sort of reporting all along. And I don't have an affirmative answer to how either POTUS himself or the kids or the family responded to Michael's repeated inquiries, although Michael is very likely to have documents, evidence, primary sources of some of these things. So it's unlikely that when Michael is speaking with the special counsel's office, that he's not able to back up the things that he is saying. I'm trying to snake something in here, but I can't answer the question of how the family responded to these things. Clearly, if you read the text messages as we publish them, there's not a whole lot of it's very clear that the family and POTUS is leaning into Michael, pressuring him to move this deal ahead. Well, I don't have the exact responses or the nuanced conversation in that way, but I would be really surprised if Michael is just going to the special counsel and saying, oh yeah, well, it was in the hallway and I just gave him a wave. I believe that Michael was a copious note taker,
and we know he recorded things.
We know he recorded things. Yeah.
So is it fair to say? I mean, I'm not going to even frame this as a question because I'm going to say it as a declarative statement. Given
sure.
Michael Cohen's criminal history, there is, and given that he's pleading guilty to lying, there is no way that Bob Mueller is going to take his word for these on these claims over the word of the President of the United States, absent substantial corroboration of what he is saying. Do you agree with that?
I do.
So
I do, and I believe that he has substantial corroboration of these things. Yep. I mean, you don't use Mike he's a known liar. He's admitting in federal court this morning that he's a liar, right? But I also know that, we've seen in the past reporting that Michael has been known to keep receipts. And I don't assume. I know that the special counsel's office has received some evidence of that we don't have. Basically, there are things that have been turned over not just by Michael but by other people familiar with or close to this deal that I don't have access to.
Right.
I sure would like them.
Okay, so there's another major story that you guys wrote that also plays into this story, and that is your profile of Felix Sater.
Mm-hmm.
Because Felix Sater shows up in this instrument as individual number two.
Individual two, yep, that's Felix.
Who is the principal conduit through which Michael Cohen is trying to arrange the Trump Tower Moscow deal.
Indeed.
Now, for listeners who do not remember your Felix Sater story, which is one of the most astonishing profiles of anybody I have ever read, it is a account of how this criminal lowlife dealmaker becomes a long-term cooperating witness for not just a certain set of investigations, but basically a sort of FBI undercover and CIA undercover individual for a very long period of time in the context of a plea deal. He
is the better part of a decade.
Yeah, I mean,
he is an asset for the U.S. government on a wide variety of cases.
And it is fair to say, well, we knew he was cooperating with the investigation a long time ago. It is fair to say that if there was ever doubt that Michael Cohen is a serious cooperating witness, that doubt evaporated this morning. And so you now have the two principal people involved in this deal are both cooperating, presumably wholeheartedly. And so I'm interested in your thoughts on what the next major investigative step is. Where do you take this investigation from here?
I mean, so there's a couple of ways. I'll address Felix first. I am of the belief that he has long been a faithful cooperator with the special counsel's office. He knows Andrew Weissman personally. Andrew Weissman, prosecutor on the OC team, that personally signed off on Felix's lengthy sentencing agreement. So he knows better than to walk in there and lie. So they have it appears they now have a cooperation of both Felix and Michael. And I wonder whether this moment can lead to deeper questions about possible collusion.
All right, let's talk. Let's talk, because that's where I think everybody, when they read this document, they are going to say, this looks a lot more like collusion than anything that has been charged before, though it is not about emails, right? It's not about hacked emails or social media manipulation or any of the subjects of either the GRU indictment or the IRA indictment, right? It is, on the other hand, it is the Trump Organization seeking to do business with the Russian government into the campaign and lying about it, right?
Deeply into the campaign.
Deeply into the campaign, like right up to the right up to the convention.
Setting it up so that they would bring him to Moscow. If we could only wait till after the convention, and holding firm to that lie for the next, how long has it been? 18 months? 2 years now? How long?
Right. How does this relate to the question of collusion? I mean, I think we all feel in our bones that it does, but when you, what is the theory of the case that this has, you know, is some business deal that is kind of unrelated to to the hacking stuff and the Russian intervention in the campaign, or are these integrated in some way?
I believe that they are part and parcel. I do not believe that they are two totally different efforts. I think there's going to be additional reporting around this tower, and some of the individuals that both Michael and Felix Sater were in contact with as they attempted to build it. I think it would be beneficial to people to go back and understand like who the individuals were that Felix was talking to and that Michael assumed he was talking to. These are not random oligarch dude. These are people with ties to the Russians intelligence services, and to see them pop up in a real estate deal, you know Felix, it's not outside the realm of possibility that he's talking to folks like this pretty regularly, and is not involved in some larger thing. But there's something to this that Ben, I gotta be honest with you, I don't understand. Right. Like I don't want to get out of turn. I don't think Michael or Felix have anything to do with actual collusion, but I'm not certain that this wasn't an attempt by Russia's intelligence services to see how comfortable the campaign would be with certain things.
The period in which this is taking place is the period in which the emails are being hacked, and right around when they're starting to be dumped, right? Mm-hmm. And so do you think it's possible that this is part of the Russian perception that this is a guy that you can do business with and you'd want to help at the expense of Hillary Clinton, because, look, I mean, he says nice things about Russia and he's trying to build a big building and he's proud to know us. Why wouldn't we help him?
Sure. Sure, there's some of that, right? Like they, you know, they've been trying to build this building for, what is it, more than a decade, right? This is, I mean, Felix Sater took Ivanka Trump to the Kremlin at one point, let her spin around Vladimir Putin's chair as part of a negotiation to build this tower. They've gone through a number of developers. They worked with, you know, they actually had financing in place or attempts to get financing in place. I mean, there's a lot. It's possible that they just, this guy's cool, you know, if we can do two at one time, great. But I'd point to one thing in a story, in our story that we published so long ago. And it was from two Bureau officials, and I'm gonna tell you that they have detailed knowledge of the actual collusion investigation. And they told us that Michael Cohen was in contact with foreign individuals about this tower, about this deal, and that some of those individuals, according to our sources, had knowledge of or played a role in the actual meddling. I don't know. I wish to goodness that I had an idea of who they were, but I still don't. And after checking in with some folks more recently, that thing still stands. That as part of this negotiation, there were foreign agents who also had a role in the meddling. Does that amount to collusion? I don't know. Right. Could it be that these were unwitting participants and, you know, we're just trying to build the tower? What the hell do we know? Possibly. But there's more to be known here. I gotta do some reporting.
I'll let you do that. Anthony, thanks, congratulations and thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, as always, my friend. Talk soon.
Take it easy.
Bye.
All right. There's a huge amount on the table, guys. Susan Paul, how big a deal is this?
So I think it's a very, very big deal. But we've seen a lot of revelations that are very, very big deals. And so it's hard to know what piece this plays in sort of the cumulative body of evidence. It's hard to know what piece it plays in the cumulative legal theory. And I think most importantly, it's hard to know what role it plays in the cumulative political consequences of all of this. I think that this is a story in which, from the outset, we should take a moment to acknowledge that it's not just about legal technicalities, although there is all kinds of illegal conduct at stake. Even setting aside the legal questions, the President of the United States, after he had secured the Republican nomination, was negotiating not with random Russian business people, which would have been bad and problematic enough, but with the Kremlin, with Russian officials. That is not acceptable conduct. And so I think it's worth just foot stomping that before we go down the rabbit hole of, by the way, in addition to this core infraction, exactly the kind of behavior that the founders included the emoluments clauses to prevent against, there might also be all kinds of illegal conduct that occurred. So I think that's my first instinct in sort of understanding how big a deal it is.
All right, so let's start there. Let's bracket all the legalities and all the technicalities for now and just focus on the gestalt picture on the wall. Paul, is there anything unfair about what Susan just said?
The only thing that I think is unfair about it is that I think almost all of it has already been priced in to people's purchase of Trump, which is to say most of his supporters have long assumed that he was doing deals and even deals with the Russians, and they just don't care. They should, I mean, I think they should. They've already priced it into their purchase of Donald Trump. They like him because he's a businessman. They assume that he's doing business deals with everybody, including the Russians and the Saudis. And they think that that means that he's a smart man, right? And they shouldn't disregard this, but they do. And I doubt that this will move the needle in the larger political salience sphere. It won't change his approval rating from 38 to 35. It won't lose him a single vote amongst the House Republicans. All of it, it should. It absolutely should. But especially since the deal was never consummated, and so we're still waiting for the proof of purchase, if you will, the idea that money went from Russia to Trump to buy him. That's still an unproven assumption, maybe highly speculative. That's the only thing that's going to move the needle.
All right.
I regret to say that, but that's true.
Okay, so I want to ask a sort of non-legal extension of this. I'm entranced by Susan's idea of starting this conversation at a very non-legal kind of what's acceptable level. Is this collusion? I mean, Anthony and I were talking about that a little, but, you know, on the one hand, it has nothing to do, or at least it doesn't seem obviously to do with emails, right, with disclosure of emails or with intervention in the campaign in the sense that we have been concerned about it. On the other hand, as Susan says, wait, what about the foot stomping? Here is the Trump Organization in the midst of this campaign trying to do a deal with Russia, with the Russian state, at a time when the president says, I have nothing to do with Russia, I have no business, right?
And at a time when the Russian state was actively intervening in the electoral campaign.
Right. So here's my question. How does this engage the main thread of the collusion story?
So I think to answer that a little bit, you do have to go into the legalities. So I think what this does on the collusion front is substantially advances the narrative towards not just parallel interests, but coordinated interests and actual ties between. That said, whenever we think about the potential legal issues, even though we're not talking about collusion, conspiracy, in order for this to be a conspiracy in the sense that we're, you know, sort of the most extreme possible account of, you know, Trump-Russia collusion, you do need to have a meeting of the minds. You actually have to conspire with one another. And I don't think that this, I think that the more significant information that this raises lots of questions about but isn't included in this is not the agreements about negotiating deals or having meetings. It's the agreements about hacking information, releasing information, or potentially any joint effort to conceal that. And so I think this is really significant, but I don't think it gets us all the way to sort of even, I don't think it even sort of gets us yet to the subject matter that we would need to say, okay, this is the collusion.
What do you think, Paul? Is this, should we understand this fundamentally as a collusion story within the sense that we use the term collusion in connection with Trump-Russia matters, or is this just some other thread?
Well, I'm with Susan that there's still a piece missing which connects the two threads. I'm of the view that it is more likely that the explicit connection is probably in Russia rather than in America. That is to say that the Kremlin, being a much more tightly controlled and unitary organization, is not going to have Mr. Peskov negotiating for Trump Towers access to Moscow, and the GRU doing its work to steal emails, and the IRA doing its work to influence the election. It's not going to have those two things happening in a disconnected and uncoordinated way. There's a linchpin there. It's probably in the Politburo. It's probably as high as the level of Putin. At least that's what the IC has suggested is the case. On the other side, the linchpin hasn't been built between the Satter cone efforts to build a building and get investments and make money, and the apparent Manafort, Corsi, Roger Stone efforts to embolden and use stolen information that the Russians might be providing to assist the campaign. On the U.S. side, what it is beginning to start to look to me like, absent that linchpin, is a case of what we call corporate knowledge or collective knowledge. Lots of companies get prosecuted when one person knows, you know, one piece of the puzzle and another person knows the other piece of the puzzle, and they don't know both. They both don't come together to have individual liability, but the corporation does. And Trump Organization is starting to look like a corrupt organization, a racketeering organization.
I want to make one point that I think is important and sort of embedded in Paul's comment there, and that's that the Kremlin knows the answers to these questions. And unless the answers here are the most innocent possible explanations, this really is all a big giant coincidence and it just happens to look bad. If it's anything other than that, the United States is in an incredibly dangerous position, because the United States is in a position in which the American president is aware that a hostile foreign adversary potentially has devastating, politically devastating, and potentially legally and criminally, if not for him, members of his family or organization. The hostile foreign adversary has that information on him, and that really are the sort of conditions in which your kind of worst nightmares about blackmail and influence you come out.
And just to be clear, when you say information here, we're not talking about the P tape, right?
No, we're talking about the answers to the questions that Paul just said, right? Where is the linchpin? What is the coordination? So maybe what the Kremlin knows is there's no coordination at all because nobody coordinated with them. And so they're sitting pretty, just watching this all unfold, and the chaos Muppets that they are enjoying themselves. On the other hand, if any forms of coordination occurred, from the most sort of minor, although I'd argue there's nothing minor here, to the most extreme, the one group that we know for sure, other than Trump, knows the answer to this question is Putin.
All right. So I want to make, since neither of you have done it, I want to make the hard, strong argument for this being fundamentally a collusion story. Not because I necessarily believe it. I'm at least attracted to it enough to think it's time to have a serious discussion about it. Let's look at this from Bob Mueller's point of view. We know he is investigating the heck out of the Roger Stone, Julian Assange, Jerome Corsi, Randy Credico mechanism by which information emails became public and information about that found their way to people who were allegedly found its way to people who were in the orbit of the Trump campaign. We know he's working that issue very hard, and we actually know because Mr. Corsi was good enough to disclose the draft
kind
criminal.
Kind soul that he is.
Yes, kind soul. We actually know something about what Bob Mueller thinks he can prove here and wanted him to plead to. We also know that when Bob Mueller got access to Michael Cohen and got him in a cooperative posture, the thing, of all the things that Michael Cohen is involved in and was involved in, and the thing that he is, you know, pleaded guilty to today, involves this building in Moscow.
Can I just make a point that in support of your view? Mr. Mueller has shown a laser-like focus and a willingness to hive off unrelated things. If this were really just about vindicating Congress's right to truthful testimony about a topic that was sort of unrelated to his core, I would have imagined that he would have given this to the District of Columbia. The U.S. Attorney Jessica Liu is quite a good attorney. You know, and there would have been an information and an indictment and bing, bang, boing, just as he did with Southern District, New York. So that's exactly right.
So moreover, I'm going to go even stronger. Moreover, and the more I'm talking about this and hearing you vamp off it, the more I'm actually talking myself into believing it.
Be careful. We want to believe it. So let's not do that. But, yeah.
So moreover, not only has Mueller been disciplined in the way that you're describing, he's actually hived off aspects of Russian interference in U.S. politics. See Maria Butina, see Elena Kucinova. And so I think when you take that together and you say, okay, what has the Mueller investigation actually been about? It has been about, as best as I can tell, two things and two things only, or maybe three. One, the collusion question, Russian intervention in the 2016 election by various means and cooperation with, coordination with that by people on the U.S. side. Number two, obstruction of that investigation. And number three, underlying criminal activity by Paul Manafort that was probably of interest to him because he thought Manafort was a person of interest in connection with item number one. And so when I look at him then coming in and saying, okay, Trump Tower Moscow is mine. I am doing this myself, taking it back from the Southern District of New York because it is in my area. And I'm going to make this guy plead to it. And I'm going to use the plea to put out a lot of information. And by the way, people talk about the GRU and IRA indictments as speaking indictments. This is a speaking criminal information. This is an information-rich storytelling document. I look at it and I say, and he's doing this just at the time that we know he's ramping up the email investigation with respect to Roger Stone, Randy Credico, and Jerome Corsi. I look at it and I say, Bob Mueller believes this is about collusion, and he's trying to communicate that. Discuss.
Possibly. I think we should always hesitate to know what's in Bob Mueller's mind. I think, once again, it's worth noting, yet another indictment or yet another plea agreement that nobody saw coming. He runs a tight ship.
Bob,
there are not
operational
leaks.
Security Mueller.
It is a lesson to a great many organizations. I think that's an entirely plausible theory. I think that it's far more likely that what we see in terms of substantive outcomes of the special counter investigation are related to collateral crimes. And that's not because of Mueller's instincts one way or another. It's because that's usually what comes out of these kinds of investigations. And I do think that this story, when you think about the collateral crimes of false statements, of perjury, this is a moment that substantially raises the peril for any number of individuals. And so I think it's, I don't disagree with you, but I think if we're going to see real movement or this be sort of a fulcrum point, it's going to be related to lies to the special counsel's office and federal investigators, potentially lies to the grand jury, lies to Congress, and then this whole other category of lies to the American public.
So, Paul, what do you think of my theory?
I like your theory. I hope it's true. I'm not as persuaded as you are. There's another kind of piece to this, which is a really interesting piece that I wonder if it's part of the message sending. Typically, lies to Congress are prosecuted by U.S. Attorney's offices, the U.S. Attorney in the District of Columbia. The U.S. Attorney in the District of Columbia is appointed by President Trump. Might not be so interested in vindicating Congress's interests in truth-telling on this particular topic. Might not be interested, for example, in enforcing subpoenas that the next Congress might issue on penalties of contempt. Mueller is also sending a message that he's a separate avenue by which Congress can vindicate its own interests if it's related to the Russia investigation. And that might be a motivation for him to expand his kind of sphere a little bit, not as a way of pulling that in himself and saying this is related to my Russian collusion and conspiracy investigation, but as a way of saying, you know, the process of law is important, the standards, the rules of appearance in front of Congress are important, and I will help Congress vindicate those by criminal informations like this, so long as they are even tangentially related, which would be an alternate motivation, and I think a very laudable one. And I should say, by the way, I don't want to be heard as actually saying that there's any evidence that this U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia would be reluctant to do that. But we've had a long history of congressional contempt citations falling on fallow grounds because the Department of Justice is a creature of the executive branch, and the contempt is usually against people affiliated with the executive branch. So there's just that tension going on.
So you think to the extent that there's a speaking element here, one of the people he's speaking to is Adam Schiff.
Yes. If I were Adam Schiff, this would make me very happy because this would be something that I would trot out in front of everybody who either has already come in front of me or will come in front of me next month.
Okay. So this brings me to a question that Susan doesn't know how eager she is to have me ask her, but you're going to see. Susan, how bad does Devin Nunes look today?
Super bad. Not great, Devin. Turns out you didn't manage to talk to everybody you needed to. I actually think Devin might have done us a little bit of a favor here because Devin brought in people like Donald Trump Jr. And Donald Trump Jr. made representations before a committee of Congress under oath, under criminal penalty. And he said things reportedly like that his father, Donald Trump, did not have foreknowledge of this Trump Tower meeting. A number of other associates are now reported to have made that representation to various forms of investigators and congressional committees. Most significantly, the President of the United States is reported to have made that representation in written answers submitted to the special counsel's office just last week. Now, last week, the President already knew that Cohen was no longer his friend, but he didn't know, for example, that Paul Manafort's deal had completely fallen apart because the special counsel's office knew that he was lying. The conduct described in this information, not just about what Cohen is doing, but who Cohen is briefing, and they're very specific to talk about the level of communication with individual one, who is Donald Trump, with family members of individual one within the organization, that creates the conditions in which it is almost impossible to believe that a meeting in which Russian-connected individuals purported to bring information from the Russians damaging to his opponent. And so while we don't know yet, this is yet another piece of information that I think takes the answer to that question away from, well, people who don't like Donald Trump and think he lies about things were already suspicious and inclined to believe that, and into the realm of, no, we now have a pattern of communication that simply doesn't square with the account of these people within the campaign acting completely without the knowledge of the candidate on matters of Russian relationships.
So, but on the Devin Nunes point particularly, it seems to me the way he conducted the HPSI investigation was you put a whole bunch of people, you get a bunch of representations by people like Michael Cohen, you take them at face value, and then you write a report that says we couldn't find any evidence of collusion. And then Anthony Cormier and Jason Leopold look into the history of the actual history of, and they do it without subpoena power, by the way. They look into the actual history of the Trump Tower Moscow deal, and they realize that these representations are not accurate, and you get a serious investigation, and these are not truthful statements. And I wonder, you know, how much that HPSI report, if somebody goes back and reads it today, is going to be basically, you know, we asked the obvious subject of the investigation. He said nothing going on, so nothing going on. And it's going to look really stupid, at least on the points at which it may have relied on Michael Cohen.
Well, it's good. It's hard to, for Devin Nunes to look any more stupid than he already does, right? So, but this will be. So I actually
he just got reelected, Paul.
Well, that
by
says
single digits in Fresno.
Yeah,
so
that says
maybe
more about
keep the
people
champagne
of Fresno.
Corked.
Sorry, people of Fresno. I apologize, but I actually have an interesting question that I don't know the answer to. So I'm going to use your podcast to beg for an answer. May a subsequent Congress refer for prosecution false statements made to a prior Congress? That is, may Adam Schiff's Democratic HPSI Congress refer for prosecution false statements? I imagine that it's a matter of House rules, as to which I know nothing. Of course, it's possible for someone like Mueller to take up that mantle sua sponte. But historically, the Department of Justice has waited for Congress to say that it wants this particular interest vindicated.
Though they didn't this time.
We don't know whether or not there was communication between Sissy and
that's true.
And I'm assuming we also don't know whether there was between HPSI and Mueller. I'm assuming that Devin Nunes didn't report this, but as far as I read it, this is all silent on whether or not Burr and Warner might have kicked this over. Or it may have just fallen out of the debrief of Cohn on unrelated matters in which he said, "Oh, by the way, I lied." Yeah. But I'm curious whether or not HPSI can refer matters from the 116th Congress during the 117th session.
So I don't know the procedural answer. I agree it's interesting, although my instinct is that they could.
I would note
that one of the things that Adam Schiff has been talking about in the past 2 weeks has been his intention to make transcripts available to Mueller. That was one thing that the special counsel's office didn't have, that they had, the HPSI had all of these transcripts, but the special counsel's office didn't have access to them. And that was one of the questions about making them public, what could be shared. Obviously, there's a lot of sensitivities there. And so if Schiff is interested in getting these documents to Mueller, it suggests either he thinks there's substantive new information in them that is significant, or he thinks that there is substantive false information in them, which is significant. And so I do think that that's a little bit of a hint that the probable chairman of that committee likely thinks that that is a fruitful area moving forward.
Okay, so I want to talk about the Howard Baker question. What did the president know and when did he know it? This document is, presents a variant of that question, which is that it presents one side of a whole bunch of communications. That is, Cohen briefed the president repeatedly. He briefed members of his family repeatedly. And it never says what the other side of those communications is. So when Cohen responds, how did the president or the candidate respond? No, I assume that that is a purely strategic judgment on Mueller's part not to release that information at this time. But it raises the question of what possible answers the president could have given to those that would or would not be incriminating. And my underlying question is, what's purported to be illegal here? So leave aside Susan's very correct point that what's outrageous is what was done, whether it was legal or not. But if you're a criminal prosecutor, your interest in this is presumably your interest in making a criminal case. There's nothing illegal about wanting to build a building in a foreign capital, even an adversary foreign capital, while you happen to be running for president. And as far as I know, negotiating with the president of that adversary foreign country to build a building. So imagine that every time Trump had these briefings from Cohen, his response is, Michael, let's work this real hard. Push, push, push. Let's get it done. And I want to go to Moscow to break the ribbon on this right after the Republican convention. Make it happen. Assume it's the worst possible Donald Trump answer. Paul, what's the president's exposure here on this?
On that, almost nothing, right? The exposure, if there is any, is in the evident attempt to conceal that from the American public during the course of the campaign. And even that's not criminal. What is criminal would be lying about it under oath when asked about it, as Cohn has admitted he did, or asking Cohn to lie about it. So if Trump either lied himself, asked Cohn to lie about it. This really, we were talking earlier, this reminds me so much of how the Clintons got in trouble. Most of their business dealings were not in any way criminal. They just were unseemly, and they didn't want them to become part of the public discussion. And so when asked about them by the press during the campaign, they lied about them or they concealed material facts. Then when asked about them under oath by the Resolution Trust Corporation they maintained the same story that they had told the public, and because they couldn't change their tune.
And of course, that's true of the Monica Lewinsky matter.
Exactly.
In a non-business context.
Right, exactly. And so both of those were instances in which the investigation of the Clintons wandered into the criminal sphere because they maintained the cover-up or the concealment in fora in which they were obliged to tell the truth.
Okay. So
that would be Trump's problem too.
So
maybe.
So what would be the points at which that would present? So he was supposedly answered a question about this, according to some news reports, last week in his written answers. So that's one where he may have misrepresented it. What are the other points where the effort he may have engaged in an effort to conceal this legal but unseemly behavior?
The only other significant affirmative place would be if Cohn coordinated his false statements to Sissy and Hipsy with the president.
So that's that's really parallel to the Lewinsky situation.
Right. Yeah. If before he went in, he said, this is what I'm going to say. And the president said, good, or more aggressively, if the president said, Michael, I know you're going in, you got to say this, keep the faith, baby. So those are the two places where it is. And then, of course, as you mentioned, he has now submitted written answers to Mueller, potential 1001 charges, if false.
Susan, what do you think? What is the area of presidential exposure here, other than the ones Paul identified?
So again, I want to be careful because it does depend on facts we don't yet have. But I do think that there is possibility of exposure here. And that is that to engage in a criminal conspiracy, you don't have to know about the entire conspiracy. You don't have to participate in the entire conspiracy. You have to know that it exists. You have to have sufficient knowledge. And you have to participate in your part of it, even if your part of it is not necessarily facilitating illegal acts. The crime can be, you can conspire with somebody else under which you're doing something purportedly legal and they're doing something purportedly illegal and you are committing a crime by conspiring.
Okay, but I'm still wondering, like, so like, unless you're hypothesizing here a connection to the emails stuff, what's the possible areas where that, you just make up some facts if you need to, but what is the areas where that would, like, this would play out that way?
The Trump organization is engaged in a real estate business deal negotiation with the Russian government. They are aware that the Russian government is having those communications with them, potentially are disposed to give them favorable treatment because the Russian government would like consideration whenever the individual becomes president of the United States. The Trump organization realizes or understands that in order for the Kremlin to realize its investment, he has to be elected president of the United States. The Trump organization or some group of individuals realize that the Kremlin is undertaking activity that is illegal under U.S. law in order to facilitate that end. Again, you need pieces that are not yet in evidence, but I do think there's a way that if you take the hacking, right? You take the clear criminal activity, the active criminal activity that Mueller has already charged, and you start building the conspiracy around that, I actually do think that there is a way that with sufficient coordination, with sufficient knowledge, this is all part of a same sort of enterprise.
So I'll answer it a different way. If there's no link between the business deal and the hacking, which I share with Susan high down. But if there's no link, if it's just the business deal, if the hacking hadn't occurred, then you've got a odd little question of whether or not an anticipatory violation of the emoluments clause can be criminal. And the answer is almost certainly no. I would say this though, the one piece that we haven't talked about that is actually of graver concern to Trump, I think, than anything that we've been talking about, is the finances, the money. How is this getting paid for? Where's the money coming from? Is he laundering proceeds? I mean, there's been lots of stories about the one piece that Mueller has done that you didn't talk about, which is the subpoena to Deutsche Bank for information about Trump Organization finances, the apparent cooperation of Weisselberg, with respect to Trump Organization finances.
He's the accountant for the Trump.
He's the accountant, CFO, isn't he?
I thought he was the CFO.
Yeah. Well, okay. Either way, he's the inside money guy. So, you know, the only way that the Trump-Russia business deal becomes criminal without any reference at all to the campaign is if there's something corrupt in the deal itself, as to which we don't have that much information, but lots of speculation. It's the New York real estate market, for gosh sakes.
Or frankly, the inverse of that. If the campaign is spending any money towards securing the real estate deal, or if they are doing anything that uses money covered by federal election law in order to repay or incentivize or otherwise create a commercial gain, you could have sort of the inverse arguments.
As you do, in fact, in the Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal matter. I suppose you could imagine a very similar situation here, right, where the Trump Organization is doing something for a sufficiently obvious, in regard to Trump Tower Moscow, for a sufficiently clear campaign purpose that you could raise campaign finance questions. All right, before we wrap up, I want to talk very briefly about Paul Manafort, because this action comes at precisely the time that it has become very clear that Paul Manafort's cooperation with the special counsel has shall we say, not panned out to be everything for which Bob Mueller would probably pray. And we've learned this incredible fact from the New York Times, thanks to Rudy Giuliani, that Manafort's lawyer has been A, part of the joint defense agreement this whole time, and B, operating as a intelligence operation against the special counsel for the benefit of the president. So, Paul, you have worked both the prosecution side of special counsel investigations, and you've done your share of representing lowlifes. How does this grab you?
Well, let's first say that we should discount by about 80% whatever Rudy Giuliani says, even to the New York Times. He has a long and storied history in the context of this very investigation of saying things that just ain't true. And there's at least some reason to not believe that so much, because Manafort's attorney, Kevin Downing, has, you know, it was a longtime prosecutor in the Department of Justice, in the tax division, generally well regarded in the white collar criminal defense bar, generally thought of as competent. And if, in fact, he is he was feeding intelligence back to Trump on the Mueller investigation, he will never be able to represent a client again, because none of his clients will ever be able to enter into plea agreements with any prosecutor ever again, because he will have broken this kind of absolute barrier and bond. The way that this works is when you change sides, when you plea, you withdraw from the joint defense agreement. One of the values of a joint defense agreement is that it's a great signaling thing. If you and I are in a joint defense agreement and I send you a letter, dear Ben, I've got to leave, I don't have to say anything more. You know that I'm about to take off my MAGA hat and put on my Team Mueller hat or whatever. And that is, at least as a matter of law, based upon the minimal condition of a joint defense agreement, which is that we share a joint interest. And if I've pled guilty, that's dissolved the legal grounds for any joint defense agreement between us. So in some ways, it's a highly implausible story that Rudy has said. If it's true, besides the fact that Mr. Downing has ruined his reputation for all eternity amongst all prosecutors in the United States, he also probably, and the president also probably, have made a strategic mistake. Because if they continue, if you and I have continued to have discussions after the joint defense agreement is abrogated by my change of side, our discussions are no longer cloaked within the bounds of attorney-client privilege. And that applies not just to what I tell you about what Mueller is doing, but whatever you, Rudy Giuliani, tell me about what the president's thinking. And so, you know, it's an open question whether Mueller will be sufficiently, will want to be aggressive in getting inside that. But he's broken. Yeah, he's got a way now, if he chooses to take it, into, you know, Rudy Giuliani's thinking about what Trump has told him. If Giuliani ever said to Downing, Mr. Trump says X, that is no longer cloaked in the attorney-client privilege. And if what Giuliani said about Mr. Trump says X is different from what Mr. Trump told Mueller in his written answers, that's a big problem.
And a small footnote on that point, on the attorney-client privilege point, the way that Mueller would potentially want to use that information is not in the context in which you might be able to litigate the question of attorney-client privilege before a judge. In a report, he could produce that information. So actually, to the extent that there is, you know, a plausible or credible legal theory that the attorney-client privilege doesn't apply anymore, it would be even easier for Mueller to avail himself.
I don't think you give it enough credit. It's not a plausible or credible legal theory.
Sure.
I would say that it's going to be a very hard sell to suggest that the attorney-client privilege remains. All that having been said, the last piece of this is, if it is true, if Downing was and Manafort were serving as an intelligence arm, you know, that explains a lot of Mueller's anger at Manafort, and Mr. Manafort had better be counting on that pardon, because otherwise Mueller's going to put him away until he dies.
So I just in, you know, I do think Maggie Haberman and Mike Schmidt and the other people, you know, at the New York Times are very savvy about Rudy Giuliani's propensity to talk not necessarily out of his mouth. And I suspect, I think it's interesting that Kevin Downing has not contradicted the story, at least not that I've seen. And neither has anybody else, to my knowledge. And so, and in fact, one of the interesting things about the story was the degree to which they were able to show that the president was tweeting things that seemed to come from knowing something about the special counsel's interactions with Paul Manafort. And so I am, your hesitation, I understand, but I do think we're dealing with an at this point uncontradicted report by very savvy and sophisticated reporters who don't have a track record of getting major things like this wrong. And so my
I have no doubt that Giuliani said it, and you're right that if that one of the tells is that Downing has been silent, that's the dog that didn't bark. If he really did this, boy, yo, I wouldn't want to be his next client.
We are going to leave it there. This has been a special edition of the Lawfare podcast. Now, we don't have music on special editions of the Lawfare podcast, but if we did, they'd be performed by Sophia Yan. This one came together really fast, and thanks to Matt Kahn and Michaela Fogel for audio engineering. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. It is, as always, produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Now, there are a lot of people who listen to special editions of the Lawfare podcast who don't listen to the other ones. And some of those people, I know, and if you're one of them, I'm talking to you right now, have not given us a rating yet. And I want you to correct that error in your behavior and your comportment toward life, because the Lawfare podcast doesn't advertise. We don't have big validators, and we don't have, you know, sponsors like MeUndies and that, you know, we only have you to spread the word about the Lawfare podcast. And so I want you to do your part and tweet about the Lawfare podcast and share it on Facebook and make sure you actually do give us that rating, because that's the way we spread the word about it.
Can I make a plug? It's Christmas time. I just was on the Lawfare swag shop, and I bought over $200 worth of merchandise for all my friends and family. Really cool hoodies, sweaters, mugs. Everybody's getting one. They don't know it yet, unless they listen to the podcast. I'm talking to you, grandsons.
So there you have it. And then let the record reflect that I did not solicit that. You should go to the Lawfare store, which has been down for the last 24 hours, but is coming back. You should go to the Lawfare store. And by the way, if you're inclined in the holiday season to support Lawfare financially, the support Lawfare page will gladly help you with that. And as always, thanks for listening.